This is a Charles Russell Speechlease podcast.
Hello and a big warm welcome to this podcast on mental health at work. I'm Anne-Marie Balfour and I'm joined by Simon Spanges, my colleague today. We're both employment lawyers at Charles Russell Speechlease and looking forward to discussing mental health at work from the legal perspective. It's obviously a very topical and important issue for employers. 14.7% of people experience mental health problems in the workplace. 12.7% of all sickness absence days in the UK can be attributed to mental health problems. And better mental health support in the workplace can save UK businesses up to £8 billion annually. So I think it's clear from that intro that employers need to be paying attention to the mental health of their employees.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think we're going to need to convince anybody who's joining this podcast of the importance of why it's important to support mental health. But I think those statistics definitely show that it goes beyond legal obligations, doesn't it?
That's right. So promoting and protecting good mental health at work, preventing those problems arising in the first place, it's important for lots of reasons. Of course, obviously, just from a general responsible and compassionate human being perspective, we want to be looking after each other's well-being. And then, of course, there's work to be done. And for commercial reasons, if we protect employees' mental health, that can boost productivity and staff retention. And as if those reasons weren't enough, of course, employers have legal obligations to comply with when it comes to the mental health of employees. And broadly, those legal obligations in relation to mental health fall into three main pots. There's personal injury law, and in the employment area, just as in the world at large, personal injury is relevant. Employers can be liable for work-related injuries to an employee, and that includes injuries to minds as well as physical injuries. So there's personal injury law. Then we have health and safety law, and that imposes statutory and common law obligations on employers. So, for example, duty to provide a safe system and place of work, conduct risk assessments, and to maintain employers' liability insurance. And then there's employment law. And of course, being employment lawyers, that's what Simon and I would like to focus on this morning, starting, I think, Simon, if we can have a look at disability discrimination
and
mental health.
Absolutely. So focusing on those legal aspects for now, someone with a mental health condition could well be considered to be disabled and therefore be protected from discrimination under the Equality Act. And many of you will already be familiar with this definition, but under the Equality Act, a disability is a physical or mental impairment which has a substantial and long-term adverse effect on an individual's ability to carry out normal day-to-day activities. So on the face of it, you can see how many mental health conditions could well fall within that definition. Someone with depression, for example, would clearly have a mental impairment and it would have an adverse effect on their ability to go about their normal daily routines. For a condition to be substantial in practice, that's a very low standard. The effect really only needs to be more than minor or trivial. And for the effect to be long-term, then it has to last or be likely to last for at least 12 months. But there are some tricky areas that we do come across with that definition of disability. The main one is that the mental health conditions are not always obvious, as some physical conditions might be.
That's right. Sometimes even employees sometimes may feel a bit embarrassed and want to cover it up, which can make it harder to spot, can't it?
No, absolutely. It's a very private thing. And there is still, unfortunately, stigma around it, which hopefully is getting better. But some people just might not want their colleagues to know about it, or they don't want to be seen as not coping. And so it's quite difficult sometimes for an employer to spot it. Also, some conditions have reoccurring or fluctuating effects. So the effects might not appear to be long-term on the face of it. It might only impact an individual in particular situations. Maybe there's a particularly busy period at work, which causes them additional stress or anxiety. Or it might be triggered by something in their personal life, such as a bereavement, which would then impact their work. So I think the important thing to note is that even if the effect of the condition ceases, then it could still meet the definition of a disability. And the approach that tribunals take to this is to look at the likelihood of reoccurrence. So they'll consider whether it might well occur again. So you know, could it happen again in that individual's lifetime? And would that happen at least 12 months after the first occurrence? So that's a very difficult assessment for an employer to make. And really, the best approach is that if you do have somebody who has been off sick for a few weeks or a few months, don't make the assumption that they're not going to meet that definition of a disability. It's still important to support their mental health in the workplace, you know, because it might stop it from becoming a bigger issue further down the line and maybe even prevent them going off sick in the first place. Okay, so if a mental health condition does meet that definition of a disability, then there is protection from discrimination under the Equality Act. And discrimination claims can take many forms. So we're going to run through a few of them just briefly today. So you could be looking at direct and indirect discrimination, harassment and victimization, discrimination because of something arising from a disability, and also a failure to make reasonable adjustments. So if we talk through a few examples just to highlight how those claims might come about. One of the important things to note is that the protections under the Equality Act are not just limited to employees. It can also include workers, job applicants, and some self-employed contractors as well. So, for example, if you have a job applicant who comes to interview and they meet all of the criteria the employer is looking for, and during the interview they might disclose that they have a mental health condition, maybe because they're explaining why they've got a gap in their work history, and then they don't get the job, they may well turn around and say, well, actually, I've been directly discriminated against. I've not been given that job because I disclosed my mental health condition. And then it would be up to the prospective employer to show, actually, no, there was a non-discriminatory reason for their decision. Another interesting point is that people with past disabilities can also be protected by the Act. So, for example, if somebody doesn't get a promotion, maybe because they know in the past they've had a mental health condition and they don't think that they would be able to cope with the additional stress of the promotion, they don't get the job, they could still say that even though they don't have a disability now, they'll still be discriminated against because of that past disability. Looking at indirect discrimination now, an example that we are seeing a lot of sort of policies which seem on the face of it to treat everybody equally, but actually in practice put people with a mental health condition at a disadvantage. This could be maybe an employer requiring their employees to return to the workplace full time, be in the office, no ability to work from home. We're obviously seeing that a lot more. So they may have a legitimate aim that they're trying to achieve with this policy. You know, you're trying to promote in a collaborative work environment, better team relations and that sort of thing. But you can see how somebody with a mental health condition might be put at a disadvantage, particularly if they're anxious about traveling on public transport at peak times, for example. So the employer would have to show that there's not a less discriminatory way of achieving that aim. You know, could that be achieved through a hybrid working arrangement or team video calls and that sort of thing? Or, you know, could you vary the hours so the individual could come in at off-peak times and that sort of thing? Moving now to harassment. So this is where there's unwanted conduct which is related to a disability, which has the purpose or effect of violating dignity or creating an intimidating, hostile, degrading, humiliating, or offensive environment. So there are some pretty obvious examples. Obviously, you can't make derogatory comments about somebody's mental state after they've returned to work or anything like that. But there are some less obvious examples too. You know, if a colleague isn't invited to a social event or not included in some way, maybe because they just don't think that they'd be interested or because they've been off for mental health reasons, you can see that they might not intend to cause offence, but if that individual feels, you know, left out or ostracised or stigmatised, then that could potentially be a form of harassment. Looking at victimization, so this is where an individual is subjected to a detriment because an employee has done a protected act. And usually that protected act is something like raising a grievance that they've been discriminated against in some way. So an employee may say, you know, I've been treated badly by my employer because of my mental health issues, or my employer hasn't done enough to support me. And then after they raise that sort of complaint, the employer does something which the individual sees as a detriment. Now, detriment is very wide. It can be anything which disadvantages that employee, such as not offering them a promotion or disciplining them or putting them through a performance management process. So that's just something to be aware of if that happens. Looking now at discrimination because of something arising from a disability, this is a really interesting claim that was introduced by the Equality Act to provide more protections for employees. And this is where an employee is treated unfavorably because of something arising in consequence of their disability, which the employer can't objectively justify. So a very common mental health example would be where an employer dismisses an employee on non-term sick leave for capability instead of working with them to try and facilitate a successful return to work. So there, the decision to dismiss is not because of the disability, but it's because of something arising as a consequence, i.e. their need to take an extended period of sick leave. Now, it's potentially justifiable. So the employer might say they've got a legitimate aim of maintaining adequate attendance levels, making sure they're providing the right level of service to clients, that sort of thing. And whether it's proportionate or not would always depend on the facts. You know, what does the medical evidence say about this employee's prognosis? What's the timescale for recovery? Is it feasible for the employer to wait that long? And have they tried reasonable adjustments to help them to get back to work? And that brings us on nicely to the duty to make reasonable adjustments. So this duty arises where a disabled person is placed at a substantial disadvantage compared to those who don't have a disability. And that's because of an employer's provision criterion or practice, or a physical feature of the employer's premises, or a failure to provide them with an auxiliary aid. So the key is that the employer has to take steps to remove or reduce the disadvantage, but only if it's reasonable to do that. And that will always be fact-specific, won't it? It will sort of depend on the size and resources of the employer and whether the adjustment the employee is asking for would actually help.
That's right. So the clue is really in the name of reasonable adjustment, isn't it? I often think that the duty to make reasonable adjustments is one of the most onerous laws for employers in that it can be so wide. And also, unlike other statutory duties like the right to request flexible working, with reasonable adjustments in a disability context, it's very much the burden's on the employer to spot what might help. So it's not a case of waiting to see whether the employee asks for something. The duty arises as soon as the employer's really on notice.
Yeah, and that's key. So it's a positive, it's a proactive duty. The tribunal is going to say, well, either you knew or you should have known about that disability, the disadvantage.
That's right. So it's very much thinking about what do we know and what might help. And last year, ACAS released a new code of practice on reasonable adjustments in relation to mental health, so exactly on this point. And it's really quite helpful in that it lists some examples of some possible reasonable adjustments in the mental health context. We won't look at them all, but it's worth a read if you're dealing with something like this. And the guide, the code of practice, groups them under changes to working patterns and hours, which could include more frequent breaks or paid time off for medical appointments. Then there's changing the employee's role and responsibilities. There's reviewing relationships with others in the workplace, methods of communication, changes to the working environment itself. So that could be, for example, managing noise, distractions, or facilitating rest breaks. And then there's adding support. So that could be, for example, modifying supervision arrangements, providing training or coaching, or arranging a buddy or a mentor. And as we said, it is a duty to make reasonable adjustments, not any adjustments. And that's, of course, a balancing exercise, having regard to things like cost, the chances of the adjustment actually being successful, the impact on the organisation more widely and on the workforce as a whole.
Yeah, so there's a lot of considerations, isn't there? I think that it's important to just talk to the employee as well, because what works for one employee is not going to work for everybody. So having that conversation is important. And also, having a look at whether it's important to actually get some medical evidence about what the employee's condition is.
That's right. And in particular, with mental health conditions, as we were saying, it's not always obvious to the employer. And sometimes it won't be obvious to the employee either what their condition is, how they're affected by it and what the employer might be able to do to help. And that's when some expert guidance could be really helpful. And that could be something from the employee's GP or another doctor who's treating them, or from an occupational health practitioner or a specialist doctor appointed by the employer. And of course, it's a very sensitive matter and a personal private matter for the employee, and quite intrusive asking for some medical reports. And so it's not surprising to find that the law does put some considerations in place for some protection there. So a few tips on medical reports. It helps to include in the contract of employment at the outset an obligation on the employee to agree to a medical assessment. Of course, that doesn't mean that the employer can force the employee to attend a medical assessment, but it can make it easier if you end up in one of those difficult, uncooperative situations. But even where you have that consent in the contract of employment, that obligation in the contract of employment, and even where the employee in principle is happy to go ahead, as an employer, you would still need to have regard to a piece of legislation called the Access to Medical Reports Act 1988, or AMRA for short. So if an employer wants to apply for a medical report from a practitioner who's been treating or has been responsible for the care of an employee, so that could be GP or consultant already treating them, then AMRA will apply. On the other hand, if it's a one-off report from a new doctor who's appointed by the employer, AMRA won't usually apply, but in practice, what you generally find is that doctor will still insist on following that process. Mm-hmm. Belt and braces, really. But often they'll be quite helpful and have their own forms of this as well. But in summary, it's a bit complicated, but in summary, if AMRA applies, it provides that employers can only apply for a medical report on an employee if they've told the employee in writing that they intend to do so. Then the employee has provided their explicit consent to the employer making that application, and the employer has advised the employee of their rights under AMRA. And then, having done that, the employee can then choose whether to withhold consent to the report, to agree to the application and to the report just being sent straight to the employer, or the employee instead can say, I approve the request for the report, but I want to see it before it's sent to the employer. So that's really, in a nutshell, what AMRA does. Still with medical reports, obviously health data counts as special purposes data, and that's the category of data which has the highest protection under data protection legislation. I think, Simon, we could probably fill a whole seminar on this issue, but we won't, because there are more interesting things to talk about. But just really to flag that the Information Commissioner's Office has published some helpful guidance for employers on this. And so it's important to remember it is that special category data when dealing with this and storing it. And also an interesting point of data protection law here is that it's an offence for an employer to require an employee to make a subject access request. So that's a data subject access request from the employee to a doctor about their health, and then produce a copy of that to the employer. So what an employer mustn't do is, instead of getting a medical report in the correct way, instead saying to the employee, you need to make a data subject access request to your doctor and then show me the results of that. That will be an offence.
I think the data protection considerations just highlight how important it is to make sure that when you're contacting the doctor, you're producing quite a narrow and focused list of questions for them to answer, isn't it? So you're not asking them to produce all of the evidence about, you know, this employee's mental condition. It's just the stuff that's relevant to their ability to carry out their job.
Exactly right. And I think this is quite a common area for problems down the line, isn't it? When if things don't work out well, and then later on you're at the disclosure stage in a claim, and The contemporaneous correspondence around this issue comes up. So yeah. Important to remember that documents like your internal emails between managers and notes of meetings and letters of instruction to doctors and any drafts of them, they can be disclosable either in response to a data subject access request or as part of disclosure and litigation. Helps also to choose medical experts carefully, obviously. So you would ideally seek recommendations from somebody you know who's used that expert in the past, but looking not just for the right expertise, but also looking at availability and how quickly a report can be produced, and somebody who is in the right location to consult with the employee. And I think you need to allow plenty of time for medical reports. It can be surprising how long it can take sometimes. And then really, just as Simon was saying, drafting the letters of instruction, requesting the medical reports, being careful to be unbiased, careful not to make assumptions and not to guide the doctor towards what might perhaps be the answer that the business is looking for.
Yeah, I think it can be quite difficult for employers, can't it, if they try to go through these steps and then the employee withholds consent for the report to be disclosed. And in those circumstances, as long as the employer has shown that actually they've tried to seek medical evidence, and they probably just have to go ahead on the evidence available, don't they?
I think that's right, having done all we can.
Yeah, and if they do get a report, obviously the next step would be to discuss it with the employee, look at the recommendations that the doctor makes, and see what's feasible, what can they actually put in place to try and make it work.
That's right. And also having regard to other information, they're not just sort of blindly following the report. It's important to be looking at all of the other information as well, which might be outside of the report. But yeah, the reports can be hugely helpful sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. But what if the employer has tried everything? What if they've gone through that sort of process and just it's not feasible for any particular reason for the employee to return or for them to stay in work and do the role that they were hired to do? What do they do then?
Exactly. And that brings us to the procedures which HR professionals be familiar with, which is the Smith-Hellman performance management procedures or capability procedures, as are required by law. And many of you be well versed in those already. One outcome, of course, is when an employee is being seriously affected by mental health difficulties, and then following some very careful, without prejudice discussions, the parties can agree terms for the employment to come to an end. And when that happens, it's usual for those terms to be effected through a statutory settlement agreement. And in this context, the mental health at work context, there are some of the standard settlement agreement clauses in the settlement agreement. They're not always suitable, and there are some helpful changes to make and some additional points to consider, and we thought it might be helpful to have a quick look at those. So for example, the settlement agreement will probably refer to various payments, and that might be salary to the termination date, notice pay, and just on rates of pay. It helps in this, where there's been long-term sickness, to be very clear about what exactly that money sum is or what that rate of pay is. So instead of the usual wording being usual salary, if it's not going to be calculated at the normal working basic salary, for example, it's going to be SSP or at the enhanced sick pay rate, or it's going to be zero or something else, just important to make that clear to avoid any misunderstandings and then a dispute down the line. A big topic in this area is PHI, permanent health insurance,
yes,
or sometimes called the group income protection plan, or critical illness cover. And employers need to be really careful here. So sometimes the sums involved can be quite substantial, and it's important to be careful in your settlement agreement that if for whatever reason the insurer doesn't pay, the wording doesn't mean that the employer is left to make those payments, which can be an awful lot of money sometimes. Be careful wording around that. Where a settlement involves a BHI payment, it's worth making sure that all possible outcomes have been considered and addressed in the agreement. So, for example, it might be that the claim is yet to be made and everybody's working on the basis that the claim will be successful. But in fact, the insurer might refuse the claim. The insurer might perhaps approve the claim, but then subsequently cease to provide the benefits for whatever reason. And also the employee might get well and want to return to work. So, and it might be that the employee will breach the conditions for the insurance payment to continue. So all those things that just might mean things don't turn out quite how everyone's expecting at the time of signature. So we're thinking them through, and where necessary, drafting for different eventualities. Sometimes it's possible to join the insurer as a party to the agreement, particularly when they've agreed to commute the benefit into a lump sum rather than the ongoing monthly payments. Mm-hmm. And that's something worth speaking with insurers with, and then making sure it's all matching in the settlement agreement.
Yeah, we do see that, don't we, sometimes, but it sort of depends on the terms of the policy and what you can get the insurer to agree to.
That's right. And sometimes that can take quite a while, whereas you've got your dialogue going and everybody's keen to move on and have the certainty of the settlement agreement in place. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those areas where the standard wording doesn't normally work.
Yeah.
Another one of those areas is personal injury. So it's very common for a settlement agreement to include a waiver or a carve out for certain personal injury claims, normally the latent ones that they don't know anything about, but still keeping a waiver of personal injury claims that the employee does know about at the time of signing. Now, where the employee has alleged that there's something about their work or the employer's conduct that's harmed their mental health, there might be some discussion about not waiving the claims in quite the same way. And it's a matter for negotiation. So what works depends on the settlement. Obviously, for employers, it's that clean break that they'll be looking for. If it's going to be agreed that the payment will be made, but not all personal injury claims will be waived, then it's just important to make sure that the business understands exactly what claims are not being waived and whether the business is still happy to pay the settlement sums only with a partial waiver. So just being clear what the business is getting for its money. But it often comes up, and there's quite a bit of discussion, isn't there, in just between the parties on those clauses on the personal injury waiver.
Absolutely, especially as the employer is trying to push for that clean break. That's why they're entering into the settlement agreement. They don't want any comeback in the future.
That's right. And another issue that sometimes can just cause a little bit of delay is share rights. So sometimes, of course, employees own shares or share options as part of their reward package, and they're normally going to be governed by some share plan rules or sometimes a shareholder agreement or the articles. And when an employee leaves, there are normally rules about what happens to those shares. Often the rules will treat people who are leaving for ill health reasons more favourably than those who resign or who are dismissed for poor performance or misconduct. And it helps to understand what the position is with the shares as early as possible in a negotiation. And before the settlement agreement's drafted, just so that everybody's clear and knows what's going to happen. And to get that right from the outset. And also with settlement agreements, tax can be another issue. So many of you will be familiar with the favourable tax treatment of compensation payments on termination of employment, where eligible payments can be made without deduction of tax up to £30,000. And of course, payments in these settlement agreements where somebody's been unwell can be a lot more than £30,000. I mean, I don't think that's gone up.
No.
It's in years and years and years, hasn't it?
Absolutely.
And there's another potential exemption, which could mean that more money can be paid free of tax on top of the £30,000 in an ill health situation. And that's the injury and disability exemption under Section 406 of ITIPA. So where a payment's on account of injury or disability, it can be tax and national insurance contribution free. And there's no limit. So this can be really valuable in making a pot of money available for settlement go a lot further. The test for disability is actually a different one, not the one used in the Equality Act. And the disability doesn't have to have been caused by the employment to qualify for this exemption. So it's a really useful exemption. If you're intending to rely on it, then it's important that the settlement agreement's worded very carefully, as HMRC can and does challenge the payments. And you would want to make clear that it's a payment falling very much within Section 406 with the right wording. It's sometimes possible to apply for advance clearance to HMRC when you've got a payment on account of disability. Whether to do that in terms of how you manage that with your settlement agreement process, it takes a little while. You might be able to wait and only finalise your settlement agreement once you've heard, or you can include some clauses which will provide for all eventualities instead and go ahead and sign before you've got the answer to your clearance application. So a few tricky bits and pieces, but I hope these are helpful. And obviously, we very much hope that you won't be dealing with these difficult situations we've been looking at. And I think that really brings us back to some of our opening comments on the importance of protecting people's good mental health at work, and in particular, doing what we can to prevent harm to employees' mental health at work in the first place. And so to round off, Saima, I think you had some general practical points to help employers with that.
Yeah, and I think the good news is that there's loads more guidance available for employers than there ever has been before. Also, we mentioned ACAS, and that's a useful one as well. But just practical things like we see a lot of our clients providing employee assistance programs for people so that they can get that support if they need it. And I suppose it's important to just obviously signpost people to it, not just when they start employment and they will hear about it in the induction, but throughout their employment as well. So people know that if they are struggling, then that's there and available for them. It's also important to raise mental health awareness through training and events. So you're creating a workplace culture where people know that they can talk about their struggles if they need to. They're not going to be subjected to any sort of detriment, and it's a place where they can do that. And you can train mental health champions and first aiders as well. So if an individual doesn't feel comfortable going to their line manager, they know that actually there are designated people who are trained in this sort of area where they can talk about their mental health struggles if they need to. We're also seeing more employers monitoring stress and well-being through conversations and surveys. I've seen sort of stress risk assessments being carried out and things like that, so that they're asking employees, what do you find stressful? What could we change? How can we help? And it's having that ongoing conversation, keeping on top of it, which shows that actually you're committed to supporting mental health in the workplace. So really, it's just about actively considering and implementing steps to make work no more stressful than it really needs to be.
Thank you. That's the key, isn't it? Making it no more stressful than it needs to be. I think it's not possible to remove it altogether, but lots of food for thought there. Thank you very much for joining us for the podcast. I hope that it's been interesting and there are some helpful things to take away. Goodbye.
This is a Charles Russell Speechleys podcast.